like a company. Ready!
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again.
Welcome to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is podcast number 80. We're like the Energizer Bunny. We just keep going and going and going. I am your host, Bob O'Connor. We're recording at the podcast studio of Sounder and Key. This podcast will post every Thursday afternoon and is available on TuneIn, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. I've been asked what my next book will be. I'm working on several, but the next one will be Remembrances of Michael Minahan of the 105th Illinois Infantry. This is the story of my great uncle, the older brother of my great grandfather. He marched with Sherman's army in the capture of Atlanta and Savannah in Sherman's March to the Sea. The book is historical fiction, but it's based on the regimental record and two diaries from soldiers of his regiment. For information on any or all of my books, visit my website at www.BobO'ConnorBooks.com. You're listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. Our guest today is a return visit of Jonathan Noyelis, of director of the McCormick Institute for the Civil War at Shenandoah University in Winchester, Virginia. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Oh, glad to be back.
Today's topic is something I know absolutely nothing about, the Battle of Cool Spring. I'm sure that many of my listeners have never heard of it either, so we're looking forward to it. Would you please tell my listeners, where is Cool Spring and why is it important?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are a lot of Civil War enthusiasts out there who have never heard of this battle, but it's a very important engagement, I think, and kind of a sits in a pristine site in Clark County, Virginia. Right along the banks of the Shenandoah River as you cross over the Blue Ridge through Snickers Gap into the valley. Cool Spring is the tail end of Jubal Early's thrust towards Washington. So after, you know, Early made the decision to break off in the second week of July, when he got to the outskirts of the capital, he decided he's going to re-enter Virginia, cross over Snickers Gap, and into the Shenandoah Valley. And when Jubal Early decided to do that, President Lincoln cobbled together, and this again I think comes as a result of the protests of Ulysses S. Grant, who didn't want to do this, he cobbled together a force of about 35,000 Union soldiers under the command of Union General Horatio Wright, who pursued Jubal Early into the Shenandoah Valley. So the Battle of Cool Spring, really, you could look at it almost as a two-day engagement. So you have lead elements of Union cavalry cross through Snickers Gap on July 17th and try to force the crossing right there at Castleman's Ferry. So for our listeners who are familiar with the valley, that area where Route 7 crosses over the Shenandoah River in Clark County, that is the area of Castleman's Ferry. And that's the area where essentially the Battle of Cool Spring began. Throughout that day on July 17th, federal cavalry couldn't do anything. The Confederates held that crossing of the Shenandoah River. And then the next morning, there were additional attempts by Union cavalry to try to break the Confederate stronghold at Castleman's Ferry. That didn't work. And General George Crook was on hand for this final effort of the 22nd Pennsylvania Cavalry to break Castleman's Ferry, and he decided that this was just foolishness. So after speaking with General Horatio Wright, who was the overall commander of that pursuit force, they decided that instead of just trying to hammer at Castleman's Ferry, that they would cross the Shenandoah River about a mile north of Castleman's Ferry, at a place known as Island Ford, cross and then flank the Confederate position. What ultimately happened was Crook and Wright are going to rely on one Union division looking at about 4,000 men commanded by Colonel Joseph Thoburn who was tasked with crossing at Island Ford. And when the Federal soldiers were getting into position to cross the Shenandoah River, these guys didn't know the area very well. They didn't know the passes and the roads through the Blue Ridge Mountains that were going to carry them to this point. So they relied on a local guide. His name was John Carrigan. John Carrigan, interestingly enough, had served in the Stonewall Brigade as a musician, deserted, and then, you know, in July of 1864 was helping Thoburn find this crossing so that he could flank the Confederate position. When Thoburn's men got to the banks of the Shenandoah River, he was expecting to have just an easy crossing. The problem is there were a contingent of about 50 to 70 Virginians commanded by Major Jesse Richardson who were there. They contested that crossing, and the skirmish fire that broke out between Richardson's and Thoburn's command, that was the signal to Jubal Early in Berryville that something drastically wrong was happening. And so he deployed Robert Rhodes' division, Gabriel Wharton's division, to the sound of that gunfire. And as George Crook was sitting up there in the Blue Ridge Mountains looking out, he could see Confederate forces getting closer and closer and closer to Thoburn's position. And he begged and pleaded with Horatio Wright to allow Thoburn to retreat to the east side of the Shenandoah River. And Horatio Wright said, absolutely not. You know, just stay the course. I'm going to reinforce them with troops from General James Ricketts' divisions. And so the Battle of Cool Spring, the main fighting of it, opened up shortly after 4:35 o'clock on July 18th, 1864. And, you know, as this battle unfolded, it became confusing very, very quickly. What ends up happening is the extreme right flank of Joseph Thoburn's line was held by a group of dismounted Union cavalry commanded by Colonel Samuel Young, about 1,100 men or so. And these guys, when they confronted fire from Robert Rhodes' division, by most accounts, they maybe fired one or two rounds, and they broke for their heels. When it became clear to Colonel Thoburn what the Confederates were trying to do in terms of flanking his northern flank, he decided to start shuffling troops around. And so as his troops were shuffling around from, you know, the far southern end of his line to the far northern end of his line, and as he was kind of realigning troops, there are entire regiments that simply broke from the field and retreated. That created all kinds of confusion for these men. So, you know, very quickly you go from having, you know, 4,000 men in action to that number almost being cut in half within about 30 minutes into the fight. Those Union troops who remained, they kind of weighed their options. You know, do we retreat across the Shenandoah River now, or do we wait until, you know, the cover of darkness? And some of them decided, well, let's wait until the cover of darkness to retreat, and they fought it out. And it's kind of remarkable, even though they were outnumbered, the soldiers who remained, they took cover behind this stone wall that was lining a road that was somewhat depressed. So it's kind of like a natural trench, not exactly like, you know, the sunken road at Antietam, but nonetheless provided them some degree of protection. And that, coupled with Union artillery that was brought into the Blue Ridge Mountains, helped them fend off, you know, several assaults from Robert Rhodes' division. But when darkness fell and these guys decided to retreat, there were all other kinds of obstacles and challenges they confronted, because, you know, there are some Union soldiers reporting that as they were retreating that day, Confederates were firing explosive bullets at them. And I remember, you know, years ago when Shenandoah University first brought me in to help research the site, coming across these multiple accounts of explosive bullets, and I thought, are they using, you know, like the Shaler explosive shell, the Gardner explosive shell? When in fact what we found based on archaeological evidence is what Confederates were firing at them were defective Confederate Gardner bullets that were notoriously you know, poorly manufactured and had air pockets and the bullets were exploding in midair. But aside from that, there is this sort of deep abyss in those waters of the Shenandoah known as Parker's Hole, which is about 45 or 50 feet deep. And Union soldiers, you know, aren't watching where they're going in the river. It's dark, and you hit that 40 to 50 foot depth, and you plummet down and you drown. And, you know, I have a number of students of mine who have been working over the past year and a half or so identifying the Union soldiers and Confederate soldiers who were killed at Cool Spring. And it's interesting in looking at the Union records, there are a number of those soldiers who are listed as being killed out there actually ended up drowning in Parker's Hole.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say, Jonathan, that I've gone across that bridge dozens of times and I had no idea that there was a Civil War battle there. And I'm supposed to be into the Civil War, so...
Yeah, there are a lot of people who don't realize that fight happened there. I mean, Snickers Gap all throughout the war was kind of this thoroughfare for both armies, and there were, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of smaller actions that occurred there. But, you know, the Battle of Cool Spring, that is the big one, because this is kind of, you know, again, this is at the tail end. These are the final moments of Jubal Early's success. I mean, Confederates, they win that battle tactically, but you know, the day after the battle, they end up pulling back toward Winchester and then south toward Strasburg, because Jubal Early learns that another federal force commanded by General William Averell is moving down from Martinsburg, so he doesn't want to get stuck in the middle with Wright in his front and Averell in his rear. So, you know, you take Cool Spring and then what happens with, you know, Rutherford's Farm and Second Kernstown. I mean, these are the final days of Confederate success in the valley, because Sheridan, once he comes in, is of course going to turn all of that around.
There are connections to Judge John Parker to the Cool Spring site. For those who don't know, Judge John Parker was the judge of the trial of abolitionist John Brown in Charlestown in 1859, and that's where I live. Please explain those connections.
Yeah, sure. Judge Parker, you know, as you said, he's most well known as the man who presides over John Brown's trial in the autumn of 1859. Judge Parker actually inherited the site that is owned by Shenandoah University now, at least a part of the site. So the university, we own, as I said, 195 acres of the retreat, which was Parker's plantation. But when he inherited the site from a family member, you know, well before the conflict happened, it was about an 1,100-acre plantation. So he largely grew based on the research that we've done, you know, grew wheat and corn. He milled his own stuff out there, all while maintaining his residence in Winchester. There are a lot of stories that have been passed down over the years about Judge Parker and how he used this property. One of the pieces of kind of anecdotal folklore that I've been told that I would love to prove but haven't yet proven it is that it was on the front porch of the house that is still stands out there. It's privately owned. It's there that Judge Parker signed John Brown's death warrant. I would love to prove whether or not that's true or false, but nonetheless, is a great story. Judge Parker, sadly, however, doesn't leave us a lot of accounts of that property. There are mentions in his diaries about it, that he owns it, you know, when he visits it. We know that he was not there at the time of the Battle of Cool Spring, but his overseer certainly was, because he wrote in his diary, I believe it was a day or two after the Battle of Cool Spring, that I received a letter from my manager, my overseer, and he said, you know, the retreat is pretty much trashed because you have, you know, all the movement of troops and casualties and, of course, the combat that's going on there. So that's another, you know, really important connection between that property and Civil War era history. So it's not just about a battle, but it's about, you know, Judge Parker's connection. There are so many questions that we have about Judge Parker's connections that we have two students who are going to be working with me this summer to really dig in a little bit deeper into those Judge Parker connections.
Please tell us how the McCormick Institute for the Civil War uses this Civil War site for its programs, particularly in relation to how the war impacted soldiers from the Shenandoah Valley and their families.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have a variety of uses for that property for our Civil War students. One of the things, and I'll get to that latter point here in a moment, one of the things that we do with that property is basically use it to not just teach our students about the Battle of Cool Spring and its place within the broader context of the war in the Valley and the Civil War as a whole, but we use it as a means to teach our students, you know, how do you go about interpreting a Civil War battlefield? What are the challenges you confront in the Civil War, interpreting a Civil War battlefield? How do you create a cohesive story? One of the things that we really emphasize out there with our students is how can we use this site, because it's not well known. We're hoping that, you know, the more programs we offer, that more people will come out there and it will become a better known site within the Valley, because it is such a pristine, beautiful, kind of a peaceful place now. But how can we use this site to talk about the ways that this battle impacted individual soldiers and families? And it's interesting, over the years, I've talked to people about Cool Spring, and they know that it has this, you know, identity as the largest and bloodiest battles fought in Clark County during the conflict, but they don't know much more about it than that. But then, you know, people sometimes, and this is actually a little bit disheartening to me, people will look at the Battle of Cool Spring and they'll say, well, there's only 13,000 troops engaged and there's only about 1,000 casualties, so it's not anywhere close to the size of a Gettysburg or a Chickamauga or Antietam, and therefore let's just discount its importance. And I always remind people when they come out there, you know, statistically it doesn't compare to the big battles of the war, but for an individual who was wounded or killed in that fight, and to their family members, that is the biggest battle of the war for them, because that has had the most profound impact on their life. So, you know, we are really telling the stories out there of all of these individuals who suffered, who were wounded or who were killed. So as I've said, you know, for about the past year and a half, we've had students working on researching through records, you know, compiled service records and pension records, you know, the lives of these 145 Union and Confederate soldiers who died at Cool Spring or died of wounds received at Cool Spring. And it's really, really heartrending to look at some of these stories and how it impacts people. So, you know, for example, there was a private in the 116th Ohio, Private Joshua Farley. He was killed at Cool Spring, left behind a wife and a child, and the lieutenant of his company, who was with him when he died at Cool Spring, basically ended up not officially adopting the child, but, you know, going to great lengths to make certain that this child received, you know, all the benefits that the government could provide, because the mother, incidentally, she died just right before the Battle of Cool Spring, so she was an orphan with her mother's death and her father's death. We look at the stories of individuals like Colonel James Washburn. Colonel Washburn, a Union colonel, commanded an Ohio regiment. He was shot through the eye, through the right eye, at the Battle of Cool Spring. And his men, they thought he was a goner. They left him for dead. He ended up surviving. But as I tell people, as I show them a photograph of Colonel Washburn, you know, that we have on display out there that was taken years after the war, you know, this guy was in excruciating pain for the rest of his life. Every morning he got up and looked in the mirror, he saw that disfigured face. He was remembered of that moment on July 18th, 1864. So we really want to help utilize this place as a means for our students to understand how you go about researching battlefields, interpreting battlefields, how you go about researching, you know, common Civil War soldiers, and how you can kind of resurrect their stories and understand, you know, the great power of their stories. I had the great fortune when I was in graduate school to study with Bud Robertson, who was, you know, one of the more well-known historians. And he always told me and always told all those Civil War students in graduate school that the Civil War is not just about battles and places and dates. It's about the people who were involved. And you have to create this, you know, kind of this personal story in order to get people emotionally invested and understand, you know, what was the overall impact of the war, that it's not just a battle's fought, a battle's won, a battle's lost, but that, you know, people are dealing with the fallout from this conflict for years and years and years and decades after it, as, you know, widows are left behind to pick up the pieces and as children are left behind to pick up those pieces.
Well, you and I have the same philosophy on these battles, because people say, oh, that was just a small battle. I said, even if there was one casualty and that was your father or your brother or your uncle, it had a significant impact on you. So don't tell me that it was a large battle or a small battle. So
that's right.
There were some hard feelings after the war emanating from Colonel Joseph Thoburn's command in regard to lack of support from General Horatio and General Ricketts. Will you fill us in about that little feud?
Yeah, sure. You know, Colonel Thoburn, as I kind of alluded to earlier, one of the things that he was promised is that if you stay on the west bank of the Shenandoah River and you fight, eventually you're going to receive support from General Ricketts' division. When Ricketts arrived on the east bank of the Shenandoah River that afternoon of July 18th, he looked at frantic Union soldiers retreating back across. He looked at the chaos that was happening on the other shore, and he said, I'm not crossing. I'm not going to put my men in harm's way because I don't think this is a battle that we can win. George Crook was with Ricketts when he had this refusal to cross, and he couldn't believe it. I mean, he was just beside himself. And so Crook went to Horatio Wright and appealed him and said, force him to cross. And Horatio Wright said, you know what, on second thought, I know I made this promise to you, but we're just going to keep Ricketts where he is, and he's not going to cross the river. This made for a very awkward moment after the battle, because after the battle was over and the survivors of Thoburn's division crossed back over to the side of the river that's now owned by Shenandoah University, there were soldiers from Ricketts' command still there camping. And, you know, all the enlisted men were basically telling the soldiers from Thoburn's command, we saw you, we wanted to come to your aid, we wanted to support you, but General Ricketts wouldn't allow it. And so, you know, the men in Thoburn's command are trying to figure out, they're trying to make sense of all this. You know, how is it that you see your fellow brothers in blue getting cut down by the score, and you just sit there and you watch it transpire, you don't do anything? So there were all these rumors that were beginning to circulate as to why this was done. Chaplain William Walker of the 18th Connecticut, he thought that Horatio Wright did it intentionally because he didn't like George Crook. He had, you know, a beef with George Crook. He didn't like him. Union veterans from Thoburn's command all throughout the course of their remaining years on this earth. I mean, you can see occasionally in the pages of the National Tribune, there was a regular column that was published entitled Picket Shots or Fighting Them Over Again. And in these two columns, you can see almost every year into the early part of the 1900s, these Union veterans from Thoburn's command saying, you know what, if we were properly supported at Cool Spring, if Ricketts' division would have crossed like they were supposed to, we would have probably won that battle, because with the strength of our position behind that stone wall in that sort of depressed roadbed with the artillery support from the Blue Ridge, we probably could have won that battle. So they were extremely bitter over that because they felt that, again, you know, they were cut off from the rest of the army. There was support there. The support didn't come. And to them, it was something that they really could not get over. And I think rightly so.
Were those sort of resentments common throughout the history of the Civil War, like after the war?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually a very unique moment. I mean, I'm sure that there are, you know, you can come up with maybe a handful of instances throughout the course of the conflict where men felt that they were abandoned. But, you know, as I sit here and think of it right now, I can't come up with another example where a division goes in and another division is sitting there just watching this transpire. So this is, I think, probably one of those more unique moments in the conflict. And I think there's also, you know, if you look at the relationship between Horatio Wright and George Crook later on in the Valley in the autumn of 1864, there might be something to what Chaplain Walker said, that, you know, Horatio Wright really didn't like George Crook, didn't get along with him. There was this almost famous now within the Valley and among Valley historians argument that took place prior to the Battle of Fisher's Hill between George Crook and Horatio Wright about who should lead the Federal flank attack at Fisher's Hill. And, you know, Wright said, I should do it because I have the, you know, it's the post of honor. It's the one thing that's going to get the most publicity. And George Crook is like, well, and he's, again, Crook is speaking through Rutherford B. Hayes, one of his division commanders at this time. But the basic message was, it's not about a post of honor. It's about who can get the job done, who has had more experience fighting in the mountains of Western Virginia. And it was Crook, not Horatio Wright, who, of course, you know, commander of the 6th Corps, was with the Army of the Potomac up to that point. So, you know, you'd like to think that a commander wouldn't have that sort of a petty attitude about things. But, you know, based on his behavior at Cool Spring, based on what he does later, maybe there is something to Chaplain Walker's assessment that it was done for personal reasons. I don't know. I can't find one way to corroborate it one way or the other. But at the end of the day, you know, looking at later behaviors, there certainly was some friction between those two guys.
What are your upcoming plans for the McCormick Institute of the Civil War for the Cool Spring site?
Yeah, so, you know, as I said, we have a lot of exciting things planned throughout the course of the summer, but our big date is Saturday, July 20th. We're going to commemorate the 155th anniversary of Cool Spring. The day will begin around 10 o'clock in the morning with about a two-hour walking tour of the battle, including going up into the heights, which provides just this beautiful view of the battlefield. And this is the positions of Federal artillery at the Battle of Cool Spring. And then we'll have, there will be some living historians out there who will be kind of recreating the movements of the armies as I talk about them. So, for example, we did this a few years ago, and it was a real crowd pleaser. I think it provided a good visual. So when we talk about, you know, the Federals from Colonel George Wells's brigade crossing an island ford, there will be Federal soldiers, you know, coming across the grounds of the retreat to the Shenandoah, kind of acting out that movement as it occurs. Aside from that, as I said earlier in the program, we'll have Dr. Jennifer Murray from Oklahoma State giving a presentation out there about how soldiers in the Army of the Potomac reacted to what was happening in the Valley that summer of 64. Dr. Jonathan White from Christopher Newport University will be on hand talking about how Union soldiers interpreted and tried to make sense of their combat experiences and the trauma of all that through their dreams. And then we're going to roll out the initial installment of our augmented reality experience, which will allow visitors to get to know a little bit better at least 30 of the Union and Confederate soldiers who fought at the battle. And again, this goes back to my earlier point of what we really want to do with that site is not just tell the story of the battle, but tell the story of the men who fought in that battle and what are the larger lessons that we can learn from them.
And can you please tell us how to get information on that from your website?
Yeah, sure. So there are a variety of ways you can keep up to date with all the, you know, the finalized schedules of things, not only for Cool Spring, but upcoming events as well. You can follow the McCormick Civil War Institute on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. The handle is at McCormickCWI. We also have a website, www.su.edu/MCWI, where we post information about all of our upcoming events.
And can you tell my listeners where they might receive autographed copies of your fine books?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've written, you know, 11 books, edited or written 11 books already. Number 12 and 13 are on the way. A lot of the local historic museums and sites throughout the valley, Harpers Ferry National Park, Cedar Creek and Belgrove National Park, Winchester Book Gallery, the Harrisonburg Rockingham Historical Society in Dayton, Museum of the Shenandoah Valley. These places carry my books, and a lot of these places have books that have already been pre-signed by me. But if you wanted to get something that's personalized, you can certainly come out to any of our Civil War Institute events. I'm pretty active on the Civil War Roundtable lecture circuit and always have a box of books in hand when I go to those events.
Well, thank you, sir, for visiting us. I learned a lot in both of your programs. Appreciate it. You've been listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. This weekend's events include a bus tour all weekend for the Atlanta Campaign based in Smyrna, Georgia. All weekend, there are anniversary activities at the Kernstown Battlefield, Winchester, Virginia, and weekend activities at the National Civil War Naval Museum in Columbus, Georgia. Today's little-known Civil War fact is this. On April 14, 1865, Abraham Lincoln attended the play Our American Cousins at Ford's Theater in Washington. In 1860, delegates of the Republican National Convention who were voting for the nominee for President of the United States attended the play Our American Cousins at the McVicker Theater in downtown Chicago. Today in American Civil War history, March 21st, 1864, two new states were entered into the Union, Nevada and Colorado territories. On our next week's program, we will feature David Goetz, who will speak on the connections of John Singleton Mosby and his raiders in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@BobOConnorBooks.com or follow us on Twitter at ChroniclesCW. Here are today's emails. First one is from the Groverton family of San Francisco, California. Our family listens to your pod each week. Our favorite programs so far are the ones where you and Mark ended up singing.
That was a great one.
That was one of our favorites, too. And the one about the Civil War preacher. We're learning something from each program. We are grateful for your programs and your guests.
We should probably build in a singing portion to these podcasts. Yeah, that was so popular.
We could sing the ending song as a duet.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we can do that.
We'll work on that.
Okay.
Another message comes from Ralph and Rebecca Eubanks of Rockford, Illinois. I know Rockford. I used to live in Dixon, Illinois. Congratulations on your great pod. We are new listeners and trying to catch up. We were wondering which programs had had the most listeners. That's a great question, too. Two programs have had over 2,000 downloads each, one on the Andersonville prison, another on Antietam Battlefield. They are programs number 1 and 3. Of course, they've also been archived the longest. An email from Bruce Berry of Jacksonville, Florida says this, "Nice meeting you at the Illustri reenactment in February. Thanks for introducing me to this great pod. I've listened to 10 programs so far, and each one is better than the rest. Keep up the good work." Our final email of the day is from Thad Manchel of South Louisiana. "I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed listening to your program. I really appreciate that you provide balanced content with your programs that focus on Confederate interests as well. I do wish you would have some more programs about the Western Theater, as all of my ancestors fought in the West, and this sad chapter tends to get little attention. I am now catching back up with your episodes since the new year. I would be happy to speak more about the Western Theater. I'm having trouble finding speakers, but if somebody would like to make that suggestion, I'm always open for suggestions. Thanks to my ace producer, Mark Guiney, and today's guest, Jonathan Noailles. Thanks to you for listening. Please join us next week, same time, same podcast location, for the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years sleeps and only my love rain now. That's all. Oh, that was perfect.
Let's not do that. What do you think?
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The The snow is on the grass again. The sun's low down, the sky low rain. Now the frost gleams where the flowers have been.